Our subject this morning and this afternoon is without distraction. So we considered first in verse 25, Paul is now giving his judgment, his guidance under the inspiration of the Spirit to virgins, which would mean single people. Perhaps some of them were contemplating marriage. Some had already entered into betrothals. So they're asking the question, should they continue? What should they do? So Paul gives his judgment in the present distress. They should remain single. But then he clarified that his guidance was not commandment. It was not a mandate of the Lord. Therefore, if they married, they were not sinning against the Lord. He said the reason he said this, so that they would not have trouble in the flesh, affliction in the flesh, he wanted to spare them that trouble. And so he gives his guidance, and it was not mandate, but it was something they were not to take lightly. Secondly, the basis of his guidance and the empowerment of it was what he began to say in verse 29. But this I say, brothers, brethren, the time is short, it remaineth. Here's the principle that so by living this way, by hope, this will be the empowerment to objectively receive guidance. When our hope is not in a passing away world, but it's in the future glory of the Lord Jesus Christ, he begins to use these five human experiences that we all have experienced for the most part and shows us how we should live in light of that day, a temporal calamity that was approaching, so that with this principle, it was going to help them have an outlook beyond a world that is passing. Because Paul says, after these five experiences, because the fashion of this world is passing away, the manner of living, the habitus, we might say, our actions, the structures, the forms, such as marriage, are passing away. So as Paul looks to a temporal calamity, we set our eyes toward a future day of glory, and we recognize there are distresses that we go through, there are afflictions and troubles we go through, that having this principle and this outlook toward future glory, our hope is in the Lord, helps us then to receive guidance. And then Paul is finally going to tell us what his desire is, beginning in verse 32. But let's look at two more of these experiences where Paul speaks of an experience we all have, but then to experience it just the opposite. He said, those that are married or have wives as if they had none, in verse 29. Verse 30, and they that weep as though they wept not, and they that rejoice as though they rejoice not, and now fourthly, as those that buy as though they possessed not. Buy. Now that's a human experience. We buy. We buy food. We buy clothing. We buy computers. We buy land. We buy houses. We buy cars. We buy vacation spots or experiences. We buy. And so Paul acknowledges that the human experience and the Christian experience is we live in a world in which we buy things. So he's not diminishing, or is he degrading the act of buying? Now that would be certainly good news for many of us. Some of us really enjoy buying, and there's nothing wrong with buying. We buy to get things to meet our needs. But Paul says, because the fashion of this world is passing away, because of the present distress, because the time is short, it remaineth from now on, from henceforth, be like people that are purchasing yet not possessing. The word buy is the Greek word for marketplace. So imagine yourself going into the marketplace of Belk. And I'm just grabbing what comes into the brain here. Belk or any other store, Old Navy, or wherever you may buy your clothes. Online, free, two-day delivery, whatever it is. You buy. You go to the marketplace. But have you ever envisioned buying, laying down the money and then walking out without the merchandise? In some way, Paul says, when you buy, act as if you're going to walk right out of the store and you leave the garments behind. The box is never delivered to the home. The car you just purchased is left on the car lot. Now, what is the imagery he's trying to tell us? The word possessed means, obviously, possessions, But it also means to hold back, to detain. So I think what Paul is saying, we should be a kind of people that when we possess possessions, they don't take possession of us. See? How would that impact your life? To buy in such a way that what we buy, what we possess, actually takes possession of us. As if what? It's going to last. What possessions do you have that you've had for very long, have not already shown signs of decay, breakdown, frustration, repair, upkeep, indicating, just from a human standpoint, that what you buy, you're never going to fully possess. You're going to give it away. That's why Solomon says all is vanity and vexation of spirit. It's like grasping for wind. It never really becomes our own permanently because it fades away. It's going away. This world is passing away. So why then do we buy and grip with such a tight grip that which we own as if it's going to last? As if to say we are holding on something with such a grasp that it has a higher value to us than it really should have. Now again, we don't want to lose sight that Paul is talking about singleness. And so we'll start there. Now single people, if you were to take audit of your schedule and your activities, is there anything on your schedule that appears that you're buying as if you are taking possession permanently? What are you buying if you look at your checkbook? If you take inventory of your life and some of the things you're doing and the time that you're spending, does your overall schedule look as if what you're doing, what you're purchasing, what you're engaged in is really the thing that possesses you? It's taken over the schedule. It's taken over the checkbook. It's taken over the life as if this world is really not passing away, that it's sort of permanent. Now, what would it look like if we purchased in a way that we held on loosely, a loose grip? It would mean that whenever those things are taken out of our grip, the impact would not be as severe as if we were hanging on tightly. Listen to Jesus in John chapter 6, verse 26. At a kind of labor that we do, that we should not labor like that. A kind of buying we should do, but not possessing. And I think Jesus is speaking in a similar way in John chapter 6, where he told the people that were eagerly searching for Jesus after he had fed the 5,000 with just a small amount of food, 12 loaves and 5 fishes. So they looked for Jesus all night. He'd gone up into a mountain, sent the disciples to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. The next day he comes to them and the people took ships. They went to the other side of Galilee and they find him as if to say, Master, we've been looking for you all night. We've been searching, laboring, striving to find you. And Jesus said, you seek me not because you saw the miracles, but because you ate of the loaves and the fishes and were filled. Labor not. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for that implied food that endures unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, because him hath God the Father sealed. Now, Paul, you remember in I think it was 2 Thessalonians, says if a man doesn't labor, he shouldn't eat. Jesus says, don't labor to eat that kind of food. Seems like a contradiction, but it's not. I think Jesus is saying, don't let your labor take possession of you. Labor is the means by which we buy. If you don't labor, you don't have any income to buy. So like Paul, Jesus is saying there's a kind of labor for perishing food that we should not do. Now, how were they doing that in that context? Jesus said, you saw my miracles, which were pointers to who I am, but rather than come to me, rather than really seek me, you were seeking the sign. Because in that sign, you found a full belly and a satisfied gut. And that's what Jesus said. The signs and the miracles of Christ were designed to point to his divinity and the fact that he's the Messiah, so that the people would then turn and labor after him, to seek him, to go after him. Well, they didn't do that. So he tells them, don't labor like that. You're laboring to put something in your belly that's only going to fill it for a short time. Paul says, don't buy in such a way that you're putting all your resources, all your time, all your schedule, all your activity in buying as if what you buy is going to last and give you a kind of fulfillment that goes on and on, because the world is passing away. So how then can we buy our food and buy clothing and labor in the way that Jesus says that we're laboring for the food of eternal life? Well, first he says, you labor by faith. This is the work of God that you believe. So it's really no labor at all. It's trusting in Jesus Christ as the bread of life. And as we buy, we're striving so that Jesus is the real food that we're after. And so we buy perishable food, which we need, and Paul says you shouldn't eat if you don't work to buy it. We don't make that food the main event. The center portion of the plate is not that food, although we consume it. It is the bread of life. So what happens when you lose buying power because of a bad economy? What happens if another government comes in and everything changes drastically? And income and purchasing power goes way down, right? Your food is still there. There's a certain kind of food, a certain kind of buying you may not be able to do anymore. The kind of car you buy may go down. The kind of house you own may go way down. But the meat that endures forever is still there. And it's Jesus Christ. So Paul says, listen, married, single, with family, wherever you are, what I'm trying to say is, when you purchase, when you buy those things that are needful, don't let them possess your soul as if they can really fill the soul. They cannot. Use them as a means to glorify God and put them in their proper place. How? By hope. By hope. And then perhaps we'll be like the Hebrews 10 Christian that took joyfully the spoiling of their goods. They had just presumably bought all that stuff just on Saturday. Maybe it was a new car, maybe it was a new house, maybe it was new clothing. And because of action they took by faith toward those that were in prison, somebody stole the car, somebody graffitied the house, and somebody burned the clothing. I'm speculating to a degree, but I know it says they took the plundering of their possessions, their goods. Why? Here's their hope. Knowing in heaven you have an enduring and an abiding substance. The word substance is the same word for goods that were taken. In heaven you have goods. You have goods that endure forever. So buy, purchase clothing, cars, houses that we need, but do so loosely. Because if our hope is in perishable things, we'll find ourselves like the Jews in John 6, which are just going after God and after Jesus for those nice gifts that God gives us. That nice prosperity and that good job and that good blessing and that nice car. And that's all God becomes to us. So Paul says, buy, but as if you don't possess, by hope. And then he says this in verse 31. And they that use this world as not abusing it. We use this world, this planet. Of course, the world is something beyond the physical world here. But we use the things of the world. We use them. We use medicine. We use science and technology. We use the land. We use to build. We use to make inventions and advancements. So whatever all is encompassed in this word world, we are those, by human experience, that make use of the world. So Paul doesn't condemn that. He says, use it. He's using a principle here. But when you use the world, don't abuse it. What does that mean? The word means excessive use. To misuse or to use it fully. Use it fully. In World War II, because of the number of men that were called away to service overseas, there was a need for the people of America to live more leanly, voluntarily. They were called on to ration their use of the world. Food, cars, gasoline was rationed. Many people started victory gardens in their own backyard voluntarily. They cut back on food. They cut back on the things they used. They cut back and started to live leanly and travel lightly. Now, why did they do this? They were hoping in victory. They were looking for victory. So everybody, children, parents, women went into the workforce to support because so many men were called away. Everybody got together. They collected scrap metal, rubber tires. They started to bring all this stuff in. They began to voluntarily deny themselves the use and means of the world in order to support the war effort in a situation where victory was not certain. It was not certain. Beloved, our hope is in a victory that is certain. So rather than use this world fully by giving it our full attention, we should use it in a way that it reveals the worth of God in the way we use it. Do you use this world excessively? Does it demand your full attention? Are you drinking deeply from the world? Are you living kind of lean? Now, if you were to take an audit of your life right now, the way you work through that would be different for each one of us. All of us right now are not living the same degree. But when you look at your life, look at your schedule, look at what you buy, look at what you do, is your life revealing a lifestyle that is using and fully giving your attention to the world? Your full attention is being driven by things other than the kingdom of God. Now you try to work the kingdom in when you can. You put it in there, but the thrust of your use of this world is it gets your full, undivided attention 6 days a week. And of course the seventh you give a couple hours here on Sunday. See, God wants us to use this world as a means to display His glory by showing He's the real value of how we use this world. Now again, that doesn't mean we all start getting lean the same way. See, that's an audit you have to do in your own life. In my own schedule, my own activities, my own life, what am I doing that shows that I've got a huge, massive straw and I'm just sucking in as much of the world as I can. And then that doesn't mean it's evil stuff. I'm consumed with giving my full attention to my life in the world, whether it's my singleness, my marriage, my family, all that I do as a family in life. Paul says when we're hoping in God and we're following this principle of using it, we must use it. It's been given to use in a way that it is not given our full attention. Rather, our whole heart is loving God. We are to love God with our whole heart, our whole mind, and our whole soul. That when we give ourselves to our work with all our might, we give ourselves to using the world in a way that God would prescribe, our attention is to the Lord in the way we use it, and therefore it is not the means whereby we are fully drinking, resting, looking, pursuing as a means to give us something that a passing, decaying world can never give. God never even designed it to be that for us. Creation was never designed by God to give you maximum fulfillment. So rather than maximize the use of the world fully for yourself, maximize the use of the world for the glory of God. How you would do that, again, may be decided differently. Just like World War II. You know, some did a victory garden, some gathered scrap metal, some did something else. But all of us should take an audit of our lives and our schedule and just look and be honest and say, am I consumed with giving my full attention to the pursuit of my own private enjoyment in the way I use what I own and what God has given me? Or is this a means to something greater? Because I know this world cannot do what I expect it to do. This world is passing away. So Paul says, because the fashion of this world... Paul, why are you talking like this? Because the fashion of this world is decaying, it's passing away. And ultimately, There was a temporal passing away coming. Some would die. Relationships would change. Some would lose their property. Why would you put your hope in something that was about to be stolen? Why would you put your hope in a person that's about to die? Although you can enjoy that person, love that person, and enjoy that object under the canopy of hope in God. It makes me think of Luke chapter 12, of the man who put all his hope in his use of a piece of property. A certain ground of a rich man brought forth plentifully. He owned the property. It was his. He made use of it. And so he should. He grew crops. He bore fruit. And the parable Jesus said was because a man came and said, tell my brother to give me my part of the inheritance. Jesus said, man, who made me a judge over you? A man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things he possesses. A certain ground of a rich man brought forth plentifully. But he had no place to bestow his goods. So he said, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger. And then I'll have a place to put all my goods. Now, you for businessmen here, this is not condemning expansion. This is not the man's problem that he built bigger barns. We know that, right? That's no problem at all. He needs a place to store his goods. It'll rot. He's got to get it in out of the weather. Not a problem. Here's the problem. After he got it all stockpiled away in the silos, he said to his soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And God said, you are a fool. You're buying as if you're possessing. You're using and you're abusing. You're giving your full attention to your land, to your purchasing power, everything that you have, full attention by what he said. You fool, this night shall your soul be required of you. And then who shall those things be that you prepare to store it up? So is every man that is rich toward himself and not rich toward God. Now, what does that mean? How are you rich toward God? Well, first, ask the question, how was he rich toward himself? He looked at his possessions as a means of rest. Take your ease. As a means of satisfying his hunger. Eat and drink. As a means of being glad. Be merry. For the long run. Many years. Many years. He lived as if this silo of goods was to be a permanent basis of his joy, his contentment, being satisfied, and having rest. That's how he was rich toward himself. How are you rich toward God? God says every man who is rich toward himself like that, he buys as if he possesses, he uses as if he's giving full attention, all these things. You're rich toward God when God is your rest. That's what the man was not, right? When God is your contentment, you're hungering and thirsting after Jesus. When God is your gladness, the man's richness toward himself in those areas is just exactly what it means to be rich toward God. Doesn't mean you give God anything. He doesn't need you. He needs nothing from you. It means when you give your affections to resting in God, to being content in God and to having your merrymaking in God, then whatever joy from a prosperous season that happens is under that richness toward God. Beloved, let us live by the principle of hope so that when we are married, we're single, we weep, we rejoice, we buy, we use. We do it in such a way that we're not married, not single, not rejoicing, not weeping, not buying, not using. And when those two come together, we're hoping in Jesus Christ and Him alone. And then lastly, verse 32, what was Paul's desire really for single and all of us? He would say it in verse 32, but I desire that you be without carefulness. That's why he's saying all this. Here's my desire for you when I use this principle and give you my guidance. He that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. Now he's talking again about singles. Here's the aim that Paul is after. If you decide to stay single and you live by this principle of hope, this will guide you in such a way that you'll be able to please the Lord with your singleness. But he that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. Verse 34, there is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and in spirit. Now notice what Paul just did. He said concerning the unmarried men that they would care for the things that belong to the Lord, how to please the Lord. For the unmarried women, that they would care for the things of the Lord. That's a repeat. Then he substitutes pleasing the Lord for being holy in body and spirit. Why? Because that's what pleases God. When you use your singleness to be holy in your buying, in your possession, in your weeping, rejoicing, and all that we just talked about. But what about married people? It seems like we just kind of got the short end of the stick there. We're just trying to care for the spouse and children, and you know, we're just kind of earthly and worldly, and we're just trying to please that person. I don't think that's what Paul's saying. He's saying your holiness is coming through mediation. See, when you get home from work, you don't get to come in and just start reading the Bible and say, I want to learn more about holiness. I don't have to talk to anybody. I don't have to spank any children this afternoon or talk to them. It's just me. I'm just going to pursue holiness. Dads, when you get home, you got to please the wife and take care of the family. Wives have to please the husband. Paul's not saying, well, you people don't even pursue holiness. You do it through family, through marriage, through children. There's a responsibility you have to be holy in that context. The advantage of singleness here is that you have no obligation. You can book a flight to India tomorrow and see Guna and serve there and come back the next week and nobody says anything. I mean, probably say something, you know, to pray and talk about it, but you don't have to get the wife's approval. You don't have to say, well, we've got to pay for education this month. I can't afford that. You know, if you can, you just go serve. Now that's just an example of how Paul is saying, Your concern is holiness without the means of responsibility for marriage and family. That's what Paul is saying there. But for both married and single, what pleases the Lord is holiness without distraction. Now we see then, without distraction means not that there's nothing else to care for, that there's no work to be done, there's no relationships to engage in. Without distraction is an above average kind of anxious distraction from the Lord because our hope is being put in other things, particularly what was mentioned in the verses between guidance and Paul's desire. And so whether single and you're kind of alone in terms of pursuing holiness, it's just you and the Lord, you have church family, you have work relationships and all of that, or as a husband, you have to please the wife and you love the wife and so you're pursuing holiness together. And you're trying to teach holiness to children. And you're doing that context. The reality is, without hope, nobody pursues holiness. And I think that's the connection. Without the principle of hope, we learn through those five human experiences, you will not pursue holiness. Why? Because you'll put your expectations in something created. And you'll spend all your time in that expectation, which is hope, rather than hoping in the Lord. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. The suffering saints, Peter says, wherefore, gird up the loins of your minds, be sober and hope to the end. For what? At the revelation of the grace of God that's coming to you. In other words, there's a future unveiling of Jesus Christ. There's more grace, beloved, in eternity than you've ever tasted in this life. You have only had a thimble of the taste of the grace of God compared to what forever grace is going to be. Do you comprehend the impact of that? Whatever foretaste, whatever appetizer of joy you've had in Jesus, it is infinitesimal compared to the grace of everlasting bliss. Peter says, hope in that. Now what will you do? As obedient children. So hoping in Jesus means, like an obedient child, you're not shaping or fashioning yourselves according to your former lust when you were ignorant of God. So when you didn't have hope, when all your hope was in a passing away world, your desire for creation shaped everything you said, everything you did, every relationship you had was shaped by a lust, a desire to find an expectation of joy in something created. That's what that means. Now that you have hope in Jesus, don't do that as an obedient child. Rather, pursue holiness. Be ye holy, for I am holy. What's the connection? You will not pursue holiness without hoping in Jesus in future glory. You cannot, you will not. If you hope in creation, there's where your time goes. There's where your pursuit goes. There's where your expectation goes. There is what you buy and you sell and you use as if it's permanent. And holiness goes. It's off the chart. It's not there. But Paul says when you're hoping and following this principle and singleness are out of it, then the single person's concern is holiness, pleasing the Lord in their singleness. And yes, you have a life too. I know I've said sometimes we think because single people are single, they ought to be doing everything because they don't have a wife. Now, that's a little too burdensome on single people. They do have a life, but you don't have a wife or a husband yet. So use your singleness to pursue holiness. What about marriage and family? Well, you're not off the hook. See, when your hope is in children, you don't pursue holiness. You pursue children. We have a child-centered home. When your hope is in marriage, you don't pursue holiness, you pursue the marriage. That's the main thing. And so Peter says, hope, get your hopes up. You can't be disappointed and then pursue holiness. And I think that's the pattern Paul is following. That we may be holy, both in body and in spirit. I speak this, verse 35, for your own profit. That's why I'm saying what I'm saying, Paul says. Not that I may cast a snare upon you, single people in particular. I'm not trying to restrict you or snare you or make your life miserable or try to put some burden on you that just weighs you down and keeps you incarcerated. No. No, Paul says. But for that which is comely, becoming, beautiful, appropriate, and that you may be devoted upon the Lord. Without distraction. Without distraction. Are you distracted this morning? I know there are distractions. Sometimes they're good distractions. Are you so distracted with a world that you have forgotten that it's decaying and it cannot give you what you think it can? Your children cannot give you what you think you can. They can. Your marriage cannot give you what only Jesus can. Your parents cannot give you what only Jesus can. So love your wives, love your family, love your children, and love your singleness in a way that you're pursuing holiness and you're putting your hope in the Lord, and let's be devoted to God without distraction, without worldly distraction, and let us follow the pattern that Paul has given us. Let's pray.